We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580, hour number two of our program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the program, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Henry Frayne, is at the controls this morning. In this hour of Focus 580, we're very pleased to have here in the studio as our guest, former U.S. Secretary of Defense, William Cohen. He served as Defense Secretary from 1997 until 2001. So this was during the Clinton administration. Before that, he spent a number of years in Congress representing the state of Maine. He was in the Senate for six terms from 1979 until 1997, and then before that served in the House from 73 to 1979. He has for a long time and continues to follow international affairs. He served on the board of directors of the Council on Foreign Relations from 89 to 97 and also chaired the Middle East Study Group. He's chaired and served on many other study groups and committees at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, at the School for Advanced International Studies, at the Brookings Institute, and continues to do this kind of work as part of the Cohen Group. Something that he started. He's here visiting the campus to give a talk. This is the annual Vaquetta DLA Piper Lecture on the Rule of Government and the Law. His talk is this afternoon at 3 o'clock in the Max L. Rowe Auditorium of the University of Illinois College of Law, and this is free and open to the public, so anyone who is here in and around Champaign-Urbana who is interested in hearing what he has to say should feel welcome to stop by. And here on the program, we'll try to talk about some of the same issues: U.S. defense policy, relations with countries like Russia and China, current events in Pakistan, Afghanistan. And questions from listeners are certainly welcome. We just ask people to be brief and stay on topic, but of course, your participation in the program is welcome. 333-9455 and toll free 800-222-9455. Thank you very much for being here.
David, appreciate to be with you.
I certainly want to talk about topics of current interest, but something that I'm interested in asking about is this. If we go back to the point where we were saying that the Cold War was well and truly over, people in defense circles were asking a couple of very basic questions. Those questions being, what now is the threat that we have to concern ourselves with? And then, what sort of defense structure do we need to meet that? So let me ask that about the first question. If you look at how we did in trying to assess what the future threats would be, how did we do?
Well, you may go back and remember at that time there were basically a split in philosophy that was taking place academically. You had Francis Fukuyama, for example, at the end of the Cold War, said we have seen the end of history. And by that, he meant that we would, with the collapse of the Soviet Empire, the fall of the Berlin Wall, we were likely to see a spread of democratic capitalism globally. Well, this produced a reaction by Professor Huntington up at Harvard, who said, Fukuyama, you got it all wrong. You have failed to take into account the role of religion. And ethnicity and ethnic hatreds. And you're looking through rose-colored glasses. We're not going to see this end of history as you've described it. We're going to see a clash of civilizations. So that was the debate that was taking place at that time. Was it going to be more Fukuyama or more Huntington? And how do you really structure yourself in that environment? And I think both happen to be right, that if you look at the end of the Cold War, you saw the spread of democratic capitalism in many countries that were formerly under the heel and boot of the Soviet Union. You even saw that in South America as well, although there's been some retrenchment on that in terms of democratic capitalism as such. But at the same time, we had Bosnia, we had Kosovo, we have Iraq, Afghanistan, you have parts of Africa where you have people who have held grudges and hatred for long periods of time, who really do hate each other. And so in that environment, you then say, well, what are the likely types of threats that we have to contend with? At that point, you may recall that President Bush 41 talked and spoke in terms of a new world order. In fact, it's turned out to be a new world of disorder. And now you have many who have been writing, from Alan Greenspan to Joshua Cooper Ramos, talking about the age of the unthinkable, the age of turbulence, the age of the unthinkable, the age of future shock, which has been written about for many years now. So we have all tried to come to grips with how do you, in a world of this kind of turbulence, organize yourself politically and organize yourself from a national security point of view to prepare for the unknown. And the military goes through something called the QDR, the Quadrennial Defense Review. And that is to try and make an assessment looking 10, 15, 20 years into the future. What are the likely threats that we're going to encounter? And I think it's not entirely clear, but it's rather clear that we're seeing the breakup of many smaller countries into these warring ethnic tribes and tribal conflict, ethnic conflict. We're seeing the spread of information and technology, which is now putting into the hands of the multitude, the masses, the ability to bring about catastrophic damage, so that once where only the Soviet Union or the United States or perhaps China or a few other countries had the power to destroy other countries, now by virtue of technology being democratized as such, we have democratized warfare.
Yeah.
So now one or two individuals, be it a homegrown terrorist or international terrorists, have the ability to inflict great damage. And that's the world in which we're living in today. So you now have Secretary Gates, for example, saying, well, for the foreseeable future, we're likely to be involved in what we call counterinsurgency or asymmetric warfare. There are still very few countries, including Russia, including China, that can take on the United States head-to-head. They're not likely to do that, not in the near term. And so you don't necessarily have to take on the United States head-to-head. You can engage in asymmetric warfare, which is what bin Laden was able to do by turning two of those aircraft into giant cruise missiles, taking down the Twin Towers and attacking the Pentagon. And so we're now faced with the spread of radicalism in a number of multitude of countries where the radical elements in those countries that may be very moderate and supportive of the U.S. or the West or the United Nations, and yet they have elements in their society which have access to technology which can bring about great damage. So what we're trying to do, I think Secretary Gates is trying to structure our current defense policies of dealing with the reality of today and for the foreseeable future, not discounting that we're likely to see the rise of China as a military power, as it is an economic power. We're likely to see Russia come back as a significant power. Now, it's not guaranteed, but they're certainly flexing their muscle now more in the European theater, more not so much in terms of military might, but energy in terms of holding a grip on Europe and perhaps altering or shaping their foreign policies, the European foreign policies toward the United States and elsewhere. So it's a world in which it's almost kaleidoscopic. If you're looking through a kaleidoscope, you turn the eyepiece a little bit and suddenly the pieces start rearranging themselves. And that's what we're seeing take place today, where there's a lot of rearranging of countries and alliances and the reshaping of policies. And it's a very fluid world that we're living in. And the question is, what is the role of the United States? Yeah. What kind of leadership can we continue to provide, not only for our security, but for the security of our allies in Europe and elsewhere? What's our relationship going to be with an emerging China and Russia, Brazil, and other countries?
Just very quickly, let me reintroduce our guest for anyone who might have tuned in. We're talking this morning with William Cohen, former U.S. Secretary of Defense. He served during the Clinton administration. Before that, spent a long time in the Congress representing the state of Maine in the Senate and the House. He's here visiting the campus to talk about U.S. foreign policy and defense policy, and questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Just to stay with it just for a minute, because I do recall, again, going back to this time that we're talking about, when people were talking about the threat and what kind of war we might have to fight. People, it seemed, were still focused on the idea of fighting a significant land war against a state government. And people were talking about how, well, we need to have the kind of military where we could actually fight two wars at once. And the theoretical scenario, I think, was North Korea and, I don't recall, was it Iran? It was Iraq. It was somewhere in the Middle East.
Right.
And I also recall now some of the things that people said after, when we're looking back at 9/11, the 9/11 Commission and others, who said what part of the big problem here was a failure of imagination. Mm-hmm. That is, we just didn't think about the fact that someone like, you know, an organization like Al-Qaeda could do what they did. And I guess so the question, I suppose, is, in fact, did we, going back to that time, fail to anticipate such a thing? Or perhaps were there some people who did and we just didn't listen to them?
You had many people talking about the threat of terrorism coming to the United States. I was writing about it with my co-author, Gary Hart. We wrote a novel about that called The Double Man back in the early 80s. And so it's something that a number of us were looking at for a long time. What the 9/11 Commission really pointed out is that we have structured our defense system and our national security system in a way that you have individual silos of information. You have the CIA, the FBI, the DIA, the Defense Intelligence Agency, and the State Department's research agency and intelligence. You had all of these silos that didn't talk to each other. So you had information that was not flowing from the bottom to the top. And then if it did get to the top, it was never shared across those silos. And that was one of the findings of the 9/11 Commission. We weren't structured to really deal with the kind of threat that is out there and is likely to be out there. And that's why they recommended breaking down the silos so that you have this cross-dissemination of and distribution of information across our intelligence and national security agencies. Have we made some progress on that? The answer is yes. Is there a long way to go? The answer is yes. Are we still vulnerable? The answer is yes. Mm-hmm. We've done a lot of things to make us safer. But we're not safe in this country as of yet, and it's always going to be a balance. So you can never guarantee 100% security or safety. If you're going to have a democracy, you're going to be open, and adversaries will take advantage of those liberties that we want to continue to treasure. So, but it's always a balancing act. To really deal with a threat confronting us, you need more information, more intelligence. What does that mean? It means that we have to start collecting and gathering information from where? From individuals. What does that mean about privacy? How do we gather information without intruding upon people's right, what remains of a right of privacy? There's not much left. I mean, there's not much that is not known about each and every one of us from the private sector, companies who gather data that is out there on every one of us. Your credit card, for example, you can't swipe your credit card without instantaneous dissemination of that information to others who have that. And the question then becomes, well, you have the private sector that has all this information on us, but do you concentrate that now in the hands of the government? Mm-hmm. And are you now getting towards Big Brother and or Orwellian nightmare, where you have a centralized government that has information on everything about you, including your political views, including your travel, including your choice of whatever you buy for your personal uses, including what you read? So that's a nightmarish scenario that George Orwell foresaw way back in the 30s, 40s. But is it now a reality in the sense that because we need to be protected against individuals who can harm us, how much information can we really gather and how do we gather it and who's overseeing it? So that if you have the government collecting this information, well, doesn't Congress have a role to play in overseeing what the government is doing with that information or how much information is gathering? And we've seen that something that started out, well, we're just going to target calls coming in from overseas to suspected terror groups in the United States. Well, big network, and everybody is kind of drawn in. So if you get a call from a local charity that you have no suspicion, it might have some remote tie to some other foundation that is suspected of being tied to an Islamic group in Islamabad, suddenly you're in the net. And that net keeps getting bigger and bigger. So these are issues that we as a free and democratic society have constantly got to address in terms of what's the proper balance. Yeah. What's the balance between security and individual liberty? And are we going to have to sacrifice one for the other? There's going to be a trade-off that's inevitable when you go to the airports. Taking off most of your belt, your shoes, et cetera. Well, that's an inconvenience. But then we're talking about body scans, and now people are concerned about body scans. And then you have the issue of should you have a national ID card? Should you have a driver's license which has an information on it which allows you to travel throughout the United States, but it's a national ID card? Those are issues in which you have serious debate, and it's not necessarily liberal versus conservative. It's one in which people are genuinely worried about their safety, but also how much does government know and how much does government take action against them without their knowledge.
Yeah. Just to talk a little bit about defense structure, we're now fighting in Afghanistan and Iraq, and while there might be some similarities, some people say a similar approach is appropriate, there are differences. The terrain certainly is mm-hmm. different. So we're fighting there. We're still, I suppose, must keep in mind the possibility that we might indeed have to fight another big land war against a state, you know, maybe North Korea, who knows. We have to have the flexibility to respond to these non-state threats. Do we know really what kind of defense structure, what kind of soldiers we need, and what kind of equipment they need, and how we need to position them? Do we really know what kind of defense structure we need now to be able to do all of these rather different things?
Well, that's exactly the purpose of the QDR, to try and identify and anticipate what kind of threats are out there and how do we structure our forces and what sort of equipment do they need in order to be able to successfully carry out the missions. You can't separate out your defense requirements from your foreign policies as well. For example, we have a policy of being forward deployed. What does that mean? We have our Navy, which is substantially reduced in terms of size and numbers, but greatly increased in terms of capability. But the purpose of having a Navy is to be able to project power. We project power into the Asia-Pacific region. Is that good or bad? Well, we have maintained stability in the Asia-Pacific region for ever since the end of World War II. As a result of that projection of naval power and our presence in the region, it has allowed a number of countries to really prosper, including most specifically China. China has been able to enact its four modernizations. Deng Xiaoping had his four modernizations. Well, why have they been able to do that? Well, it's been a relatively stable area. And when there is stability, what happens? Capital flows into areas that are stable. And they like to say that capital is a coward. So the moment there's instability, capital takes flight. Well, as a result of our presence, it hasn't been simply an act of charity on our part. It's in our interest to have a stable Asia-Pacific region. And so we continue to want to be forward deployed with our forces in Japan. We have, at the invitation of South Koreans, been forward deployed on South Korean soil in order to deter the North from attacking the South. And so this has given comfort to that region. India is included now because India also has enjoyed stability, relative stability. And so we have this. Should we continue to be forward deployed in Asia Pacific? I'd say the answer is yes, because we benefit from that. Now, with respect to other regions in the world, we have very little presence in Latin America because of historically there has been real objection to our presence there for some variety of reasons. So look to the Middle East. Now, is it important that we have a presence in Iraq? Well, that presence is about to decline. We're going to see a reduction of our combat elements by next summer and out altogether by the end of the year. That is the projection. Is it important, however, that we still maintain something of a presence in the region? Is that important to the stability of Afghanistan? And you can't look at Afghanistan without looking at Pakistan. And so everything gets interrelated. And if things go south in Pakistan, so to speak, well, what does that do with respect to India? Because India and Pakistan have not actually enjoyed a very close relationship. In fact, there have been several wars that have been fought in recent years. So you have to look at it from a foreign policy perspective and how you shape your forces and what shape do they take and how much presence can you have on the ground without upsetting the indigenous or the local population and say, wait a minute, it looks like an occupying force. To the extent you look like an occupying force, then you build resistance from within and you create more opposition. So it's always an analytical examination that has to take place in terms of what's the right amount of force. Does the country want us there? If they don't, are we imposing ourselves and should we do so because it's a threat to us and we have to be there going after the Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan, et cetera. And there's no one that can tell you with any kind of certainty. That's why you have people like Secretary Robert Gates, who has a very distinguished career as a public servant and director of the CIA for many years, and his whole background being in intelligence. Now at the Defense Department, I think he brings a gravitas to that job that carries over partisan lines so that Democrats can look to him with some confidence and certainly Republicans as well, which is what you really need. Mm-hmm. I mean, what I found in working as Secretary of Defense for President Clinton, that it was a great position to have. I give President Clinton a great deal of credit for inviting me to be the first person, to be invited, an elected official from another party to be Secretary of Defense. That was almost unprecedented. And he had the boldness to do it, and it worked. And we built a national security policy which had the support of both Democrats and Republicans.
Yeah. One more sort of defense-oriented question, then I want to make sure that we come to the president. I'm really interested in what you might have to say about Afghanistan, Pakistan. The nuclear forces of the United States always have rested on what they call the three-legged stool. That is, nuclear weapons were based on the land. They were on planes that were mm-hmm. in the air. They were on submarines under the water. Mm-hmm. And just recently, we had a conversation here about talking about the continuing presence of submarines with nuclear missiles out on patrol. And the thing that's really striking about it is that while there are, I think, not quite as many submarines as there used to be, if you look at the amount of time that they actually spend on patrol, they're actually put on patrol more than they were when the Cold War was on. Now, the focus has shifted, I understand, really from the Atlantic to the Pacific, which may be a reflection of the changing threat. But I think that some people have raised this question. They said, well, the Cold War is over, but our nuclear submarines are actually spending more time out on patrol than they were when the Cold War was on. What does that really, what does that really tell us?
Well, it tells you that there's still, even though the Cold War is over, there's still a standoff between the U.S. and Russia. We are now trying to negotiate lower numbers, but you run the risk. There's always a risk that something, it could be a flashpoint, it could be a miscalculation, it could be a flock of geese heading in one direction or the other that suddenly stirs the reaction of either country. And so as we seek to reduce our nuclear weapons, and this agreement is very important that we pursue that course of action, you still have to be on guard against any sort of misadventure or miscalculation or mistake. Now, the reason you have a triad as such is that you never tempt another country, for whatever reason, to tempt a country to fire a nuclear missile at you, because they can never be sure if you have your stationary land-based systems. Well, assuming you could take them out, you can't take out the submarines or the air component, and therefore you maintain stability by being diversified. That's still a valid concept, although what we've got to do is reduce the number both that the Russians have and that we have and encourage a non-proliferation of nuclear weapons, which is one reason why we're focused on Iran with such intensity. We want to stop the spread of nuclear weaponry, because if Iran goes forward, then we have incentives for others in the region to go forward. And then you run the risk that nuclear materials get in the hands of terror groups that not necessarily don't have to have a nuclear missile in order to set a bomb off. They can have a small amount of nuclear material that can do a great deal of damage in one of our cities. So that threat is real. And so what we're doing is we're still coming down in numbers, and what we have to do is persuade the Russians, and they want us to come down to lower numbers to match what their capabilities are today. And then you have China sitting over there, and to make sure you want to encourage the Chinese not to expand their nuclear capability. You want to make sure that Japan doesn't feel that we no longer provide an umbrella for them, that they might feel compelled to turn to nuclear weapons. Now, that's a subject matter that hasn't had a lot of discussion, but I spend a good deal of time over in Asia, and that whole subject of nuclear weapons in Japan used to be off limits. It was never discussed. Mm-hmm. Now it's discussed more and more. And so I think we have to be careful, very careful, that we really pursue this non-proliferation strategy and intensify it to make sure that other countries don't see it as being an attractive option for them to pursue.
Do you think that the Obama administration has made a mistake in scaling back plans for anti-missile defense?
I have been a very strong supporter of the anti-missile defense, not only because I felt that it's important to have a capability against either a North Korea or an Iran. You cannot defend against Russia. You cannot defend against China, because the easiest way to have an overwhelming defensive system is to increase the number of offensive weapons. So it was never designed to defend against them, but to defend against a rogue nation that could put you in jeopardy. But I also always want to have a defensive system so that if something were launched by accident, that's not beyond the scale of possibility, that something suddenly a missile is launched and you're saying, I'm sorry, we can't defend against it. There's no defense. You just to kiss your children goodbye because you're going to be wiped out. President Obama said, well, we've got a more immediate threat, and that is you've got Iran's developing shorter, more medium-range weapons, and we can defend against those. I had a problem with how it was brought about. In terms of almost like a unilateral decision, and there doesn't seem to be much coordination, at least I'm not aware of any coordination with either the Poles or the Czechs. And it was announced on the anniversary of the Soviet invasion in Poland. So I wasn't pleased with the way it was handled, and I'm open to an intellectual argument about why that makes us safer. But I still like to have some kind of defensive capability against the possibility of an accidental launch.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is William Cohen, former U.S. Secretary of Defense. He served as Defense Secretary from 1997 until 2001. This was in the Clinton administration. Before that, represented the state of Maine in the Senate. He served six terms from 79 to 97, and before that was in the House. 73 to 79.
Actually, six terms. I had three in the House, three in the Senate.
Oh, my. Oh, with six terms altogether in the Congress.
Right,
I'm sorry for the
24 years.
The correction. It served in the Senate and the House from the great state of Maine. And he is here visiting the campus. He will be giving the annual Vaquetta DLA Piper Lecture on the Role of Government and the Law. That's today, 3 o'clock in the afternoon at the Max Rowe Auditorium at the U of I College of Law, and anybody is invited to attend. We do have a caller here, someone in Urbana, so let's bring them in. Line number one. Hello.
About the missile defense system, to say that it was never conceived as a defense against Russian attack is not entirely true. Reagan certainly conceived it as such.
Right. He had a Star Wars concept. You're absolutely right. And that was rejected. And as a matter of fact, I spoke against that when he first floated the idea. But you're right. It, initially, it was a Star Wars concept that you have an umbrella over the United States and perhaps our allies to prevent a launch from the former Soviet Union.
And it is not entirely a defensive system. Its most useful function would probably be in case of a first strike on our part against the only possible target would be Russia, perhaps China, and then use it as a mop-up against any surviving missiles. You took out, say, 99% of their offensive potential, but that 1 or 1.5% that might be able to hit us, you would hope you could knock it out with the defense system. So the Russians have always regarded it as part of offensive system, not as a defensive system.
Well, of course, the Russians are the only ones who have a missile defense system surrounding Moscow. We don't have that surrounding any of our cities, but they still have a missile defense system surrounding Moscow.
True. And probably it's no more effective than ours would probably have been. It's to be remembered, it never successfully took out an incoming missile unless that missile had a homing device to guide the defensive weapon again to it, which is very unlikely that any enemy would ever provide us.
Well, you know, and that's true. The difficulty of having a national missile defense system is it should not be underestimated. But, you know, things are changing so dramatically in science and technology. And just pick up your phone today and see what its capabilities are in terms of computing power compared to having an IBM system back in the 60s or 70s. So it's not to say it's impossible. It's difficult. But I think it's something that we still should have over a period of time and take advantage of whatever breakthroughs that occur, and actually have the Russians or the Chinese participate in some kind of a system. So I'm not saying it has to be the United States. I think that we should try to find a way to cooperate with the Russians to say that we're all at risk with the spread of nuclear weapons, and we ought to try to find ways we can cooperate and reduce that threat to existential threat to all of us.
Yeah, I want to thank the caller for the question. Others are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. It's been now 8 years since we went into Afghanistan. I think we passed the official day yesterday. The Obama administration now is involved in some very intense discussions about where we go from here. And there seemed to be a lot of opinions vying. For example, the man who was our top commander there, General Stanley McChrystal, recently made some waves when he said that he thought, and I hope I'm paraphrasing him correctly, he said something like, we're at a very critical period here. Things could go one way, things could go another way. I think he said it is possible for us to succeed, but he said, we need more troops. And I think the number of troops that's been tossed around is 40,000.
Mm-hmm. Up to.
The administration was not happy at all with his comments. I think they would have just preferred he would have at least not done that publicly.
I don't think he did it publicly. I think the report was leaked.
Oh. Well, all right. Yeah, right. In any case, so they were not happy about that.
Right.
And then now there's this big debate about, okay, you know, what do we do? Do we send more troops? How many? What are we doing here? And it's also, I think, very striking that apparently now for the very first time, just a poll has come out. This is an ABC News Washington Post poll. That for the first time, more than half of Americans feel that the Afghan war isn't worth fighting. So it seems to me that it all raises the question of what is the mission? Why are we there?
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not sure that we collectively we know.
Well, you may recall that President Obama has declared from the time he started running that we were fighting the wrong war, that we went into Iraq when we should have, in fact, have stayed in Afghanistan and kept our focus there. And to say that we've been in Afghanistan for 8 years really is a mischaracterization. I think we started in Afghanistan, and then the focus shifted prematurely to go into Iraq, and that's where our forces have been with very little in Afghanistan until only recently. But it raises the fundamental point about why are we there. And President Obama has said we are there because that's where al-Qaeda had set up its operations, basically, in Afghanistan under the aegis of the Taliban. And now they're up on the border area, less in Afghanistan, more in Pakistan right now. So do we, and here is the big question on we, who is we? Is it only the United States? If we say only the United States has an interest, we're in big trouble. That we have learned through Iraq that the United States can't impose its will on other countries unilaterally. We need to have allies in this battle. And I think what President Obama has got to do, not only persuade the American people, the polls will change depending upon what they see and how he articulates the rationale for why we are there. Can he persuade the American people that it's in our interest to prevent al-Qaeda from coming back in or Taliban from taking Afghanistan over? Because if they do that, that may mean the destabilization of Pakistan, which has many nuclear weapons, which could fall into the hands of terror groups. And what if Pakistan were to then be destabilized? What does that mean for India and India's relationship with them? So it's not just looking at one country. You have to look at the entire region and what it means. And if the United States should decide that we have no interest there, what does this mean in terms of spreading the morale of those who support the concept of the Taliban or al-Qaeda in Sudan or Somalia or elsewhere? So are we seeing the spread of this kind of insurgency to other countries that will require us at some point in time to also be involved there? So it's a lot at stake. And I don't fault President Obama for saying, I need more time to think about this. But my point is, don't think about it too long, because you've got young men and women who are out there fighting and dying. And what McChrystal, General McChrystal, has said is we have a mismatch between our strategy, which is, quote, counterinsurgency, and our resources. You cannot have a counterinsurgency, which is to be distinguished from counterterrorism. Counterterrorism means we're going to hunt down, capture, and kill all of the al-Qaeda terrorists wherever we can find them. Counterinsurgency means winning over hearts and minds. And you may recall Secretary Rumsfeld, when he was at the Pentagon, he raised the question, are we creating more terrorists or insurgents than we're killing? And that remains a fundamental issue. So counterinsurgency means winning hearts and minds. How do you win hearts and minds? Well, you have to protect the people. You have to assure them you're going to be there for their protection for a fairly long period of time. You have to start building institutions that they can rely upon for their protection, police department, rule of law, etc. That's a long-term commitment. Now, the question is, are we prepared for a long-term commitment? Is it in our interest? But most importantly, are our allies in other countries also committed to it? Because if they're not, we're either all in it together or we're not in it. And I think that's something that the president's got to do, persuade the American people, number one, we have a real strategic interest in stability in that region, but number two, to make sure that our allies also are committed. Because if they're not, it's pretty clear that the polls will continue to go the other way. They will slide and you'll have virtually no support for it. You'll have more people coming home because you don't – in bodies – body bags, rather, because they don't have enough numbers to carry out the strategy. And you've got a fairly chaotic situation in which the position of the United States is now being perceived as being weak and unreliable.
Yeah.
Now, is that in our overall long-term interest? The answer is no. So the president's got a major responsibility to deal with the people here at home, the Congress, but also our allies. And they have to have an interest. They have to understand that the spread of terrorism affects them just as much as it affects us. And the bombs can go off in Madrid, in London, in other parts of the world, affecting them just as much as they can go off here.
Well, you know, given that there has been this criticism that you point to, and a lot of people have said what you said, and that is that Afghanistan was very important and that we really starved that of resources because we put so much into Iraq. So, you know, given that, and if we say that Afghanistan is important, then isn't it almost a certainty that we're going to have to put more troops into Afghanistan?
If you're going to pursue the counterinsurgency strategy. Now, again, there's been some speculation, well, the military has one strategy and the president has another. And aren't they in conflict? The answer is no. There's only one commander-in-chief. And we subordinate the military to civilian control. So it's up to the president and his advisors to develop a strategy. It's up to the military to carry it out. Now, the military, they will say, Mr. President, if you give us a counterinsurgency strategy, if that's what you decide is in our best interest, this is what we need to carry it out. Now, you can have debate within that in terms of numbers, but that's basically what the military would say. If the president says, no, I've decided we can't sustain either public support or international support for it, we're going to do the best we can by focusing on the terror groups up in the border areas of Pakistan with Pakistani support. And that remains an if you look at today's news, which you could talk about in terms of Pakistan being upset with the restrictions that are being imposed upon the aid that we're giving them. But that's another subject matter. But if you decide that that's what our strategy is going to be, using UAVs, armed unmanned aerial vehicles, and targeted killings of al-Qaeda up in the regions, well, we can carry that out too, but here are the risks. Mr. President, you're the one who decides, you and your cabinet, with the support of the Congress, what the strategy is going to be. We give you our best military advice.
Well, it seems to me, I think what you're talking about, and I know certainly there, I have read some reporting about concerns that aid that we provided to the government of Pakistan with the intention that that would be used against Taliban and al-Qaeda in Pakistan has actually been diverted into their war with India, essentially, and I'm sure that we're not happy about that because that's not the reason we provided that aid.
Right.
But that seems to point to a larger and very complicated problem, something that we have complained about, maybe not really publicly, for a long time, that is not really having the full cooperation of Pakistan. And that's where a lot of the big problem is, you know, we can only do so many things in Afghanistan. Here's another country. We have a sovereign government we've got to negotiate with. They've got their own issues. And so what do we do to get better cooperation from them?
Is to have to be sensitive to the dictum that all politics is local. For example, the Pakistanis saying, okay, you're giving us this money for a purpose dedicated in your minds to fighting al-Qaeda in these regions. We also have a threat up here, and maybe we've used that in contrast to what you want to direct the money toward. But we're a sovereign country, and we've got threats that we see as well. And there's a resentment on their part that we're dictating to them what they should be spending their money for and how they should be organized. Now, we say on the other, well, wait a minute. We're taxing American people, and we ought to have some say. And now, how do you bridge that divide? And that's where diplomacy comes in. And we're finding, for example, that the Pakistani military has gone into the Swat Valley area. You read from today's paper that they're now marshaling more forces to go into the al-Qaeda on the border areas. That comes with some domestic controversy because there are still many Pakistanis who think that that they are too close. Pakistan military is too close to the United States, so we have to. That's why Richard Holbrooke is there as our emissary, trying to bridge these divides to say we're all in this together, and we have to recognize there are sensitivities on the part of Pakistan, but they have to recognize Congress is not going to appropriate tax dollars to let the Pakistanis spend it in the ways that they think they need to spend it. So it's diplomacy that's ultimately going to have to pay off.
We have about 5-6 minutes left. I have some callers, and I do want to try to include them, but callers will help us by being brief. We'll go first to the first in line, and that's someone in Piatone, line 4. Hello.
Yes, good morning. I'll make it short and sweet.
Yes.
I'll try to anyway. I think we're fighting a political war and not a regular war, and I think you mentioned something about that. I think the generals and the people that be in charge of that are not allowed to do certain things. Secondly, whether it be Afghanistan or Pakistan, it seems to me the enemy runs when they're scared or has a chance into another country, so and that country can't touch them. And thirdly, and most importantly, those countries, whether it be Pakistan, Afghanistan, or Iraq or Iran or anybody else like that, seem to have a lot of corruption in it. So what do you do? I mean, right at this point, the smartest thing I think America can do is pull out and let them settle their differences completely out of, the Middle East, only for the sake is Russians been in there, didn't have any good luck. So other people went in there, and other countries have gone in there and never had any luck. So I think it's about time we start learning a lesson and get the heck out of Dodge. Thanks.
Mm-hmm. Well, we were out of Dodge and out of Afghanistan, and guess what happened? 9/11. So there's a penalty to be paid either way. As a matter of fact, you mentioned the Russians, an item in today's paper that NATO has now approached Russia to ask that the Russians be involved as well because they have an interest in preventing the spread of terrorism since they've had it take place on their soil as well. And it may be that the Russians want to see us get our nose bloodied, but they also have an interest in seeing to it that Afghanistan doesn't become the haven for Taliban again.
Well, Afghanistan has never had a tradition or a history of a strong central government.
That's right.
Should we think that it's going to be any different now? Because because we're supporting them?
No. As a matter of fact, what they're trying to do now is to strengthen the regional players from Pashtun leaders and tribal leaders and so forth. But no, they've never had a strong central government. It's unlikely that they're going to have one in the foreseeable future.
All right, let us talk next with someone in Effingham, line number two. Hello.
Yes. Your learned guest, I would assume, understands the Western activities, foreign policy, and wars and all that included the last 500 years. And then to digress forward as if we can win, people are people. They cannot abide the intrusion of foreign ideas and military occupation, much like the U.S. and American Indians. I know I refer to that regularly, but if I had been an American Indian at the time, I would have done everything I could have done to head off what was happening the same way in Korea, Vietnam, and now in the Middle East, which has been heaped upon by Western powers for 1,000 years. So I'll ring off, and thanks, Dave.
Mm-hmm. I suppose the question is, and this is the challenge for the United States, no matter where it is we become involved, because we see that we have interests, what do we do for those people who indeed think that we're, you know, this is, it's colonialism.
Let's look at the Middle East, for example, in Iran. It's not only the United States that fears Iran getting a nuclear weapon. You have Russia, who also fears Iran getting a nuclear weapon. China, who fears them getting a nuclear weapon. Why? Because other countries will then demand to have a nuclear weapon. So you see the proliferation of it. That's why the UN Security Council passed the resolutions. There is some debate on the level of intensity of enforcing those sanctions against Iran. But it really is about the fear of the other Gulf states saying, wait a minute, Iran is a large country. It's a powerful country. It's going to spread its revolutionary fervor throughout the region, toppling their governments as well. So they're starting to rearm or build up their armaments, and they're thinking about whether they ought to have nuclear weapons. So it's not just the U.S. looking to colonialize the region, but rather saying, is there an interest in preventing countries from gaining access and developing nuclear capability? The answer is yes. How do you stop it? Well, diplomacy, economic sanctions can't be imposed unilaterally. You have to have support internationally. Russia is supporting, China supporting, Britain supporting, the French supporting. So it's not just us looking to have a colonial imposition. It's what is the world going to look like in 10 years from now if we allow more and more countries to go forward with a nuclear weapons capability.
So I suppose then, you know, the question is, are we doing better now at building international coalitions around these issues?
Well, we'll see. I mean, the jury is out. I think President Obama has certainly demonstrated to the world that he wants to focus on diplomacy. I was at the State Department on the second day of his administration. My former colleague, George Mitchell, was being appointed to be the emissary to the Middle East. Mm-hmm. What I thought was significant being at the State Department that day is that it was day number two, and President of the United States went to the State Department to talk about what? Diplomacy. That was a very important statement he was making, and appointing Richard Holbrooke also as the emissary to the Afghanistan-Pakistan region. So I think he's demonstrated, he's reached out and saying, look, we are not going to be unilateral. We understand the limits of our power. We need to work together on a variety of issues, whether it's economic imbalances taking place in the world, or whether it's climate change, or whether it's the spread of nuclear weapons, or any of these other issues preventing terrorism taking place. We need to work together. Whether he'll be successful remains to be seen.
Yeah, one more caller here at least. Champagne, line three. Hello.
Yeah, hello. Wouldn't it be easier, instead of fighting people, to regulate the weapons manufacturing and put serial numbers in, regulate the factories so that if parts and weapons are getting into rogue hands and we capture that weapon, read the serial number, we could track the flow of it, and it'd be much easier to take out a modern factory than it would be to kill people scattered all over the world?
Well, you have to think about how many countries are now providing the weapons. You have major, in addition to the United States, you have China, Russia, other countries who manufacture weapons that go into unstable areas. So it's a big challenge.
I came across a really interesting comment that you apparently made, and this was some time ago. I think this was in the spring of 2008,
You were talking with somebody from the China Daily newspaper, and they apparently asked you something about, well, you know, how did you think China policy might change because we'd have a new administration? And you said something I think was very interesting. You said, well, you know, we have to decide, is China a friend, a friendly competitor, or an adversary? And you said at the time this was something that we still hadn't figured out. Have we yet figured that out?
I think we've yet to resolve it. I think that there are people in the country who see China as the new Soviet Union. I believe that's not President Obama's view or his administration, but there are still elements in our society that look at China and say, wow, they've got $2 trillion in foreign currency reserves right now, $1 trillion of our debt. They're getting stronger. They're going to have a much more powerful military. Are they going to be adversarial to us and contest us over Taiwan and other areas? Or are they going to be friendly competitors, which we hope that will be the case? I've made the statement before, but I had an Indian official one time more recently saying, India will always be your friend. We'll never be your ally. And it was a dramatic statement to me, but he said, look, we're going to be friendly with you. You're a democracy. We're a democracy. We have the same interests and ideals, et cetera. But we're a non-aligned country. We're not an ally of the U.S. We're going to focus and function independently of the United States. And I think the same could probably be said, hopefully, of China. They'll be friends. That we'll be friendly competitors on some issues, but we'll be partners on others. There is not a single issue that's confronting the world today that we can resolve without the support of China, or China can resolve without us. Whether you're talking about terrorism, climate change, energy security, water security, terrorism, all of these issues, economic imbalance, we have to work with China. So I see them as they'll be a friendly competitor on some issues, but they'll be partners on others. I hope we don't find we come to the point where they become a new Soviet Union. I don't think they have that in their interest to do so, and we should not.
Yeah. Our guest in this hour, Focus 580, William Cohen, he served as the U.S. Secretary of Defense in the Clinton administration from 1997 until 2001. Before that, for many years, served in the Congress representing the state of Maine. He's now the Chairman, Chief Executive Officer of the Cohen Group, and he's here on the campus to give a lecture. This is the annual Vaketa DLA Piper Lecture on the Role of Government and the Law. His topic, The Perils and Promise of the New World, that takes place this afternoon at 3 in the Rowe Auditorium at the U of I College of Law, and it is open to anyone who is interested in attending. Thank you very much.
Pleasure to be with you.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from these business partners, AgriGold Hybrids and Mohammed Anderson Foundation, Toledo, AppleLearn Incorporated in Danville, and A-Plus Farms Limited. We want to thank these business partners and urge you to help them out and join us, join in the Friends of WILL and making great programs possible. And we thank them. We also want to say support comes today from Warden Martin Subaru in Savoy at Subaru's assembly plant in Lafayette, Indiana. A zero landfill status is designed to save cost and our future environment. It's part of what makes a Subaru a Subaru. Information online at wardenmartin.com or 352-8910. This is WILL, and WILL is a member-supported service of the College of Media at Illinois. That's it for us here on Focus, but we want you to stay tuned. Coming up next is the Afternoon Magazine, the host of the show, Celeste Quinn.
Thank you, David. Coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the Afternoon Magazine, our guest will be naturalist Lyanda Lynn Haupt. We'll talk with her about her latest book, Crow Planet, Essential Wisdom from the Urban Wilderness. Let's take a look now at commodity prices. In Kansas City, December wheat is trading at $4.95 3/4, up 15 and a half. March, $5.11, up 15. In Chicago, December wheat, $4.80 3/4, up 17 and a half. March, $5.00, up 17 and a quarter. December corn, $3.69 3/4, up 10. March, $3.81 1/2, up 9 1/4. May, $3.90 1/4, up 9 1/2. July, $3.97 1/2, up 9 3/4. November soybeans, $9.41, up 29. January, $9.44 1/4, up 27 1/2. March, $9.44, up 25 1/4. May, $9.42 1/2, up 23 3/4. July, $9.43, up 22. October meal, $3.02 40, up $11.70. October oil, 30.